processing the shock in Beirut a day after a massive explosion.
Beirut looks like a ghost town, and it's just destruction everywhere. It reeks of death, literally.
Also, former National Security Advisor John Bolton sounds off on the president's quick reaction to what happened in Beirut.
When an American president speaks, it has reverberations around the world. This is something I don't think Donald Trump has ever fully appreciated, or if he does understand it, he doesn't care about it.
My conversation with former Ambassador John Bolton will also tell you why scientists are using satellites to track penguin poop from space. Yep, they know that X marks a spot. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. After yesterday's explosion in central Beirut, Lebanon's government has declared a two-week state of emergency and today a national day of mourning. Nearly 3,000 tons of ammonium nitrate produced the blast. The death toll is rising to at least 135 people, with several thousand more wounded. The cause of the blast appears to be negligence. Officials say they will find out who was responsible and punish them. Reporter Rebecca Collard begins our coverage from Beirut.
Yeah, Marco, I'm about 500 meters away from the port where this blast took place yesterday. And this part of the city is really in ruin. Businesses here, apartments here, walls are missing. You know, there's no glass in a lot of buildings. And actually, people here, there's volunteers that have come here from all over the country, and they're cleaning it up. They're sweeping up glass. They're trying to remove the debris. It's still a very chaotic scene more than 24 hours after this blast yesterday.
What have you learned today about what set off the explosion?
You know, I'm 2.5 kilometers away from where the blast took place, and it was my whole building shook. Every door in my apartment was ripped off. I initially thought this must be some sort of an airstrike. Maybe it's an earthquake. So when I first saw that they were trying to say it was fireworks, I just thought this is impossible, you know, kilometers away that you would have this sort of a situation. Now, the latest that we're hearing from the authorities is that there were thousands of tons of explosive chemicals being kept in the port. And I'll just tell you, from where I'm standing right now, I can see the port and I can see all these residential buildings. And a lot of people that I'm talking to are saying, how could there possibly be this many tons of an explosive chemical being kept in this port so close to residential areas, so close to a business district? But to be honest with you, Marco, there are so many questions that are still unanswered. The government says, of course, it's going to take days. I think it will take even longer to get to the bottom of what happened.
Are Lebanese people confident they're going to get some kind of justice for this unbelievable level of negligence?
Nobody I talked to today seemed to think that was the case. They don't. A few people I talked to said they want an international investigation into what happened, but nobody really seemed confident that there would be a proper investigation, that there would really be justice. And instead, what they were telling me today, especially these volunteers who had come from all over the country to help the cleanup in the capital, is that, you know, as soon as the rubble is cleaned up, they're going to be back in the streets protesting. And they don't, some of them even said, we don't want an investigation. We want the whole government to go. This is, you know, the final straw. There has been decades of negligence, of corruption, of mismanagement. And this seems to be another symptom of those years and decades like that. So I wouldn't say there's faith here from the Lebanese public that there will be a proper investigation. And what they seem to be saying instead is this is time for the Lebanese government to step down. And they're promising to be back in the streets protesting again, Marco.
You live, as you said, about 2.5 kilometers, so a little over a mile or so from the port. How far away do you have to get from the port before Beirut starts looking kind of normal, like no damage?
The place that I stayed last night, I stayed with a friend in Hamra, and she's about 4 kilometers from the port. And even there, there are shop fronts blown out. There are windows blown out. And I actually haven't so far been able to get far enough away to see a neighborhood that's not damaged. But, you know, I've heard even 10 kilometers away, people felt the blast. Even in Cyprus, they were saying that people heard it. Like, this is how big of an explosion. And if you see these videos, Marco, of this massive explosion and this mushroom that kind of comes out of it, it's not surprising that we're talking about miles and miles and miles away from the port. So many buildings are damaged.
So aside from the grief and the continuing emergency response, what's next for Lebanon?
As I told you, a lot of people that I spoke to today that had come from all over the country to volunteer to help clean up Beirut told me what's next is protest. So we'll see in the next few days if that happens. I think that, you know, the mayor of Beirut today seemed to be saying 1 or 2 years to rebuild the city. And at this point, standing from where I'm standing, looking at these destroyed buildings, looking toward the port, which is also destroyed, I just think that that sounds optimistic, that it's going to be a long time to rebuild this capital city, not just because of the port being destroyed, not just because of the scale of the destruction, but because Lebanon is in such a dire economic situation even before this all started, Marco.
Reporter Rebecca Collard speaking with us from downtown Beirut. Rebecca, stay safe, and thanks very much for the latest.
You're welcome.
Staying in Beirut, let us turn to Fatima al-Mahmoud. She's a senior editor at Beirut.com. When I spoke with her this morning, she told me she's emotionally scarred but physically doing okay.
Beirut looks like a ghost town, truly. It's the destruction is everywhere. You know, yesterday when the explosion happened, we were still sort of processing the shock. But waking up today, it was just a completely different scene. Like we had to face the reality of what happened last night. And it's just destruction everywhere. It reeks of death, literally.
Where were you when the blast happened?
When the blast happened, I was at home. It's just a few minutes away from the Beirut port. The building was swaying, but this is still considered like minor impact compared to what people are going through.
I understand you were with your 12-year-old brother. How did he cope during this event yesterday?
He's in a shock. He's still in shock. At the moment, he was just looking around, like looking at me like, what's happening? What is this? Before we knew it was a blast, when we just heard the explosions and felt like that gush of air and we heard the glass shattering, people yelling, he was completely in shock. My first instinct was just to grab him and run into the safest place in the house, the corridor, you know, where there's no glass, nothing breakable, basically.
What did you think had happened? I mean, and how were you explaining this to your younger brother?
First, I was like, an old building collapsed in our neighborhood because we have a lot of like those old traditional homes. And then we're like, when we heard the second sound, we're like, earthquake. And then we heard the explosion. We're like, oh my God, this is war. So it took us a while to sort of process that, okay, it was an explosion at the port. And we still had no idea like of the impact because we were at home. But then following up with the news, hearing about all the casualties, the injured, you know, the missing people, like, I literally have no words to describe.
Aside from each other, who are the Lebanese counting on for help and what are the most immediate needs?
Basically, they're just counting on civil society for help, and they're counting now on international aid and international help. Urgent needs include medical assistance and medical aid because our hospitals are overflowing with patients. So urgent needs definitely go to our medical sector first. And then people, of course, they need homes. I mean, the homeless basically need homes, clothes. These people, like, their homes are destroyed. They've lost all their belongings. So all forms of help are welcome, really.
I mean, for years, Beirut residents have taken pride in their city, but also have wondered how much distressed living they can take. So is this horrific event going to be a turning point? Are you hearing today people already saying, I've had enough, I need to leave Beirut?
Definitely, definitely. You know, Lebanese people are known for their, like, love-hate relationship with Lebanon. I mean, I, for one, I graduated 2 years ago. I'm one of the few people who are employed. But the situation recently has made me consider, you know, immigration, leaving the country. But at the same time, I don't feel like I'm making the choice of leaving. I feel like I'm forced to leave. And I think that's the case for many, many people. Like, we love our country, we love our people, we love our culture, our food. You know, there's so much to take pride in. But at the same time, we can't keep fooling ourselves. We can't keep living in denial. The situation is very, very bad. And it's either you run for it or you fight for it.
Fatima al-Mahmoud, senior editor at Beirut.com, speaking with us from Beirut. Fatima, thank you very much for your time. A lot of people are thinking about you and your city today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
Fatima spoke about people who are suddenly homeless in Beirut after yesterday's blast. Later this hour on the show, the spontaneous generosity of fellow Lebanese who jumped in and opened their doors to help. The NHL is back on the ice in a hockey bubble. Two Canadian cities, Edmonton and Toronto, hosting all the action. 5 days in, no positive COVID tests. After a nearly five-month hiatus, it's good to have the game going again, and safely at that. As the world's Roopa Shenoy reports, things look a bit different now, and it's not just the empty seats.
Join the NHL in the fight to end racism. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Matt Dumba.
Matt Dumba's Filipino-Canadian on a $30 million contract with the Minnesota Wild. He wasn't scheduled to play, but he stepped up to the center circle of players on the ice.
For those unaffected by systematic racism or unaware, I'm sure that some of you believe that this topic has garnered too much attention during the last couple months.
Dumba said the people who believe that are wrong.
Black lives matter. Breonna Taylor's life matters. Hockey is a great game, but it could be a whole lot greater, and it starts with all of us.
Please join us for the playing of the American National Anthem.
Then Dumba kneeled, becoming the first player in the National Hockey League to do so, 4 years after Colin Kaepernick started kneeling in the National Football League to protest injustice.
Oh, Canada.
When Canada's anthem started, Dumba stood.
But I think my biggest regret is not doing it for the Canadian national anthem as well.
This is Dumba talking to reporters later.
Because there is a lot of light that needs to be shed on what is happening in Canada and the oppression First Nations people have felt here for hundreds of years.
The NHL is overwhelmingly white and has long been criticized for its lack of diversity. Earlier this summer, Dumba launched the Hockey Diversity Alliance with other players of color, including Canadian Wayne Simmonds. Simmonds said they were doing it because many hockey fans are in denial about racism.
Every time I say something, people just they fail to believe.
Another black player, Evander Kane, said he'd been discriminated against in hockey since childhood.
You have to be 10 times better than that white kid just to get the same opportunity that he gets.
That was in June. In July, Eric Trump got involved. He tweeted his thanks to the NHL players in an exhibition game for hashtag standing during the anthem.
When the racists think that your sport is kind of the patriotic sport to be following, then you're doing something wrong, right? And Eric Trump's tweet is exactly that kind of acknowledgement.
Courtney Sito is a Queen's University professor who studies racism in hockey. Some NHL fans reacted angrily to Trump's tweet, posting photos of themselves kneeling at home. That's roughly when Dumba says the NHL hastily reached out to him about speaking before the game.
I think that they know that they have to react now, but their reactions have been just kind of skirting issues around anti-blackness.
Sito says it would have been more powerful if NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman had come out saying Black Lives Matter, like NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. And she says there hasn't been enough white allyship. When Dumba kneeled, he was alone. Everyone else stood.
It just seemed like a very lonely experience, unfortunately.
But Sito was heartened by the second game of the restarted season.
Oh, say, can you see?
Four players kneeled, including two white players.
I think that was obviously a ripple effect of Matt Dumba's expression.
And those players kept kneeling for the Canadian anthem.
Oh, Canada.
It is a very real belief that hockey is a white person's sport. So to say that we don't have issues of racism is a huge mistake.
Sito says addressing that racism is a long-term process that needs to play out on both sides of the border. For the world, I'm Roopa Shenoy.
With glowing hearts, we see thee rise, the true north strong.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We are all now familiar with the word lockdown. For people in the Indian state of Jammu and Kashmir, it's a term they've been dealing with for 12 months. Today marks 1 year since India's only Muslim-majority state went into lockdown. Just to refresh your memory, it had nothing to do with the coronavirus. A year ago, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government effectively stripped Kashmir of its autonomy, cracked down on travel, and imposed a communications blackout. Azer Farouk is a journalist in the capital of Srinagar. He's been reporting there for the past year and joins us now. Remind us, if you would, first, Azer, how long did the lockdown last? When were things actually eased up, and what did that look like?
Regarding the lockdown, it began on the midnight of August 4 and August 5 last year. First, the mobile phones stopped working, internet stopped working, then landline phones, they stopped working. And when we woke up next morning, there were checkpoints every 100 meters, and there were policemen, there were paramilitaries deployed. No one was allowed to move. And that sort of siege continued almost for 2 to 3 months. And then there was gradual decrease in the restrictions.
So what did you see today, Azer, on the one-year anniversary of this political crackdown?
On the anniversary, the regional administration had ordered a curfew because they were anticipating protests and demonstrations in the region. But I don't know what happened. After 24 hours, they withdrew the curfew order. But even though officially there was no curfew in place, the entire region was very deserted. There was no traffic on the roads, shops were shut, markets were closed, and there was large presence of police and paramilitary in the region, and there were roadblocks almost everywhere, and the center of the city, it was sort of a ghost place.
Azer, as I said, you're a journalist there, and we've heard in some cases journalists in Jammu and Kashmir have been arrested over the past year. What is hard about doing your job these days?
As a journalist, I mean, in Kashmir these days, being a journalist is one of the most terrible things. Because there have been instances where for mere reporting, for expressing an opinion, journalists have been booked under anti-terror laws. I mean, it's one of the most scariest things that you are being booked under an anti-terror law where there can be no bail for you.
No bail, yeah.
So being a journalist is very difficult, very tough.
What has COVID done to the region? How different were the challenges of being locked down from the coronavirus versus being locked down politically by Delhi?
I mean, they did impose a lockdown in the earlier stage. Later on, they did the unlock process, but there were no preparations for the unlock. And as they did the unlock, the cases have risen so sharp. And hospitals are such that they are understaffed. They are ill-equipped, they don't have enough beds, they don't have enough manpower to deal with the crisis. So in a way, we are heading to a disaster.
So just to sum up, I mean, a year on with the crackdown on Jammu and Kashmir eased somewhat, do you still feel under the thumb of New Delhi?
I will give you a comparative data. The former U.S. President Obama did surge of troops into Afghanistan when he sent 100,000 troops to Afghanistan. And what India did on August 5 was more than that surge of paramilitary troopers who were sent to Kashmir, and they have not yet left. So it is sort of a perpetual siege.
Azer Farouk, a journalist who joins us from Srinagar in Jammu and Kashmir, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
It's summer. Chances are you're wearing a T-shirt or at least something made of cotton. So you should really know about this statistic. As many as 1 in 5 cotton garments in the world are produced with forced labor, specifically forced labor from Uyghur people in China's Xinjiang province. That's an estimate from a coalition of nearly 200 human rights groups. In July, they published a list of major retailers worldwide that they say are complicit in this practice. Familiar names: Adidas, Tommy Hilfiger, Calvin Klein, just a few of them. Allison Gill is a senior cotton campaign coordinator at the Global Labor Justice International Labor Rights Forum, two groups that recently merged as one and now a member of the coalition. Allison, thanks for being here. Say I walk into a mall or I'm on some fashionable shopping street. How many of the retailers I'm seeing or garments I'm seeing have forced labor somewhere in their supply chain?
There's a strong chance that any number of garments that you see as you're shopping could have forced labor in their supply chain, because approximately 30% of garment imports to the U.S. are from China, and the vast majority of these have some connection to the Uyghur region, also known as the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region in China, where there is forced labor throughout the cotton supply chain.
Have you been able to zero in on the individual factories where this cotton or yarn is being produced, and you know who's working there and the conditions they're working under?
Some very credible reports have been able to do that, linking specific suppliers to specific brands and forced labor to specific factories. But one thing that's important to know is that it's impossible to do credible due diligence of the supply chain in the Uyghur region in China. So this means there's no guarantee that even a brand that is trying its best to exclude forced labor and other abusive practices from their supply chain can actually do so. And because of the impossibility of doing credible due diligence, we are calling on companies to extricate themselves and their supply chains from the Uyghur region and any connection to Uyghur forced labor.
And the problem with doing due diligence right now, is that due to the pandemic?
No, it's actually due to China's practices in the Uyghur region. It's mass surveillance, making it impossible for verifiers to speak in a confidential way to workers. Workers could fear reprisals for speaking to verifiers. People in internment camps, people in forced labor camps can't be reached by verifiers. You know, the entire system hinges on a certain level of access and on a certain level of transparency that just isn't there because of the practices used against the Uyghur people in this region.
Is a forced labor cotton especially inexpensive? And is that part of the attraction for clothing manufacturers? Like, if the price is so low, do manufacturers even want to know where it came from?
Forced labor of the Uyghur people is part of a broader campaign of the Chinese authorities against Uyghurs for political reasons. It's not to produce cotton cheaply. This is part of a targeted campaign that seeks to decimate Uyghur culture and identity. There is a Orwellian program termed as a poverty reduction program targeting Uyghurs that puts them into these forced labor facilities, some of which are linked to garments and garment manufacturing.
So have you heard a more concerned reaction from clothing companies to this very central political aspect of the Uyghur forced labor?
I think it's become pretty inescapable for clothing companies that they face a real problem if they have any links to the Uyghur region. The question is, are they willing to do what it takes to extricate their supply chains and live up to their human rights obligations?
What's been the response so far to the campaign? Have any companies stepped forward and pledged to clean out their supply chains?
Yes, a number of companies have actually gone on the record in the press to discuss the steps that they're taking. And we are in talks with a number of other brands to encourage them to sign on to our pledge and to take all of the steps outlined in the pledge to extricate themselves from forced labor in the Uyghur region.
Allison Gill, a senior cotton campaigner coordinator at the Global Labor Justice International Labor Rights Forum. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The World. Former National Security Advisor John Bolton criticizing Trump, his old boss, again, this time for removing U.S. troops from Germany.
He's not able to, in many, many cases, to distinguish his own personal interests and feelings from the national interest. He sees them essentially as the same thing.
My conversation with John Bolton coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of WGBH and PRX. As we heard earlier in the show, yesterday's explosion in central Beirut damaged buildings miles away from the blast. It's left hundreds of thousands of people without a place to live. Their homes were either completely destroyed or no longer safe to stay in. It did not take long, though, for announcements to start appearing online from people who have a safe place, offering up their homes to those in need. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
A video of an elderly woman playing piano at her home in Beirut today. The place is badly damaged. Furniture turned upside down, curtains ripped apart. There are lots of videos like this one online. People in Beirut are coming to terms with the aftermath of the explosion. This woman filmed the neighborhood close to the port. It's completely leveled. But many parts of Beirut are damaged with buildings that are just not safe to live in. The governor says up to 300,000 people have lost their homes. He said the government is working to find shelter for them. In the meantime, a grassroots campaign is taking shape by people like Ihab Kraitli.
I decided to take a personal initiative and offer my second house in the mountain, far away from Beirut, for people who got affected by this explosion yesterday.
Craigley says his house in the countryside has been empty for the past 4 months. So after the blast, he offered the place up to those in need.
I got a couple crashed inside my house yesterday. They told me that the damage was horrible. It was not a place to stay for one night, you know.
On social media, people are using the hashtag Buyutana Maftuha. It means our homes are open. Craigley says this idea of opening up one's home to strangers in need is nothing new in Lebanon. His family stayed with others back in 2006 during the war with Israel because Beirut wasn't safe.
They invited us over, and when we decided to leave because the war nearly ended, they said stay for another 2 or 3 weeks. People here are unified, you know.
For Wajih Shabbat, owner of the Shabbat Hotel, helping out with shelter was a no-brainer.
You need to support people without thinking of money.
Shabbat cleaned out 6 rooms in his hotel.
My offer was for all the people who are old, poor, okay, they are welcome to the hotel on full board basis.
Full board basis, meaning they get a place to stay and free food. Soon after Shabbat sent out his message, people started showing up in taxis.
And some of them are also injured. They came to me directly from hospital. And you can see the wounds very clearly.
Having a safe place to stay during this time is especially important for women, says 24-year-old engineering student Christina Malkoon. Since she posted about her 2 rooms, she's heard from a woman with 2 kids and another young woman who has no relatives in Lebanon.
I'm trying to help with whatever I can, so that's all I can offer for now.
Today, it seems like everyone is trying to step up and help out in any way they can, Cynthia Saab tells me. She works for a company called SCAF that sells fabrics and furniture.
You know how the glasses in Beirut are all shattered, and you know, for people to contact a glass company, this is going to take a while, especially with this overload. So we are offering a service to donate some fabrics to cover up where the glass was.
As we talk, Saab is going through the inventory to see how much fabric they have available. She said the company will send out teams to measure the size of the windows and to install the fabrics. Rebuilding Beirut will be long and painful, says Christina Malkoon. But this city has been through a lot, and she says people here know better than just to rely on their government.
The contributions they're making right now are much better than the contributions of any political leader that has made throughout the last decade, maybe. So it's really heartwarming to see the people come together right now.
For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The cause of the huge explosion that has rocked Lebanon is said to be 2,700 tons of ammonium nitrate stored in a warehouse at Beirut's port. President Trump was asked yesterday if he was confident he knew what was behind the blast.
I've met with some of our great generals, and they just seemed to feel that it was. This was not a manufacturing explosion type of event. This was a seems to be, according to them, they would know better than I would, but they seemed to think it was a attack. It was a bomb of some kind, yes.
That, of course, is not consistent with what most experts are suggesting today. John Bolton, Trump's former national security advisor, joined us today to talk about a number of things. And I began by asking him why President Trump made that comment about Beirut if he did not have the facts to back it up.
I don't think that the gravity of the responsibility really weighs on him that much. I don't think he fully understands it. So it's perfectly natural that he says, he makes comments like the comment about the destruction in Beirut, or saying that maybe Microsoft should pay a fee to the Treasury if he allows them to proceed with the purchase of TikTok's U.S. assets, or what he said this morning in an interview, that it could be years before the November election is decided, and his earlier comment that maybe the election should be delayed. These are incredible things for a president to say, and whether they are motivated by his own personal interest or just an inability to discipline his comments, it's still very disturbing.
Well, let's come back to that in a moment, how he functions and behaves. I want to get to the troops in Germany and President Trump's order to pull 12,000 of them. You said the decision showed a broad lack of strategic understanding. What do you think the president does not understand about these troops, about what they represent in that part of the globe?
The president himself gave his reasons for moving these troops, over half of whom will come back to the United States. And it was to penalize Germany for our trade deficit with Germany and for Germany not making progress toward the NATO target of spending 2% of its GDP on defense.
Do you see that as a legitimate move, to pull troops to punish Germany?
Of course it's not legitimate, but it's the way Donald Trump operates. He's not able to, in many, many cases, to distinguish his own personal interests and feelings from the national interest. He sees them essentially as the same thing. So for him, it's legitimate to do, and apparently his advisors were not successful in talking him out of it.
So if Trump wants to reduce troop numbers, U.S. troop numbers in Germany, where else is he thinking about doing that? In South Korea? There are more than 23,000 troops there.
Well, I think if he wins a second term and is free of the political constraint of having to be elected again or depending on Republican majorities in Congress, really, it's hard to predict what he would do. He has said in recent days that the number of troops in Afghanistan is going to go below even the 8,600 that he announced when he announced the so-called peace deal with the Taliban. Perhaps, Dan, I think his number was between 4,000 and 5,000, and that's on the way to zero. I think that's a huge mistake that causes real risks for the United States if Afghanistan returns to its pre-9/11 status under the Taliban as a host for terrorist groups that could strike us or our friends around the world. This is not anything like a well-thought-out strategy, and it's not necessarily going to happen all at once because he doesn't think systematically. But it's indicative of what may happen if he succeeds in winning a second term.
I'm speaking with Ambassador John Bolton, the former National Security Advisor to President Trump. So just how the White House functions with Trump, does he see others around him as being the ones responsible for grasping the geopolitical implications of big decisions and just giving him bullet points on his options? Or is it that he can't grasp them? I mean, you wrote that Trump once asked if Finland was part of Russia.
Well, I don't think he is very well informed, and I think that means almost automatically he doesn't really see the bigger implications. But even more disturbing than that, he's not especially interested in learning. What you expect from a president is that he will become familiar with the issues and the background in areas that were not part of his own personal experience so that his decisions can be as fully informed as possible. And Trump just shows no interest in that. It's, I think, demonstrated by his disdain almost for intelligence briefings and his feelings that his gut really is the place where the decisions are made. He sizes people up. He sees decisions in personal terms, doesn't need extensive briefings, and he gets things quickly and he makes his decision. And, further study really isn't necessary.
He gets things quickly. Does he always get them right?
Well, no, of course not. And I think it's dangerous to think that, let's say, in connection with the nuclear talks now underway with Russia to decide what to do as the new START treaty comes to an expiration point next year, if he's still in office, what his thoughts are on what the appropriate strategic weapons capability for the United States ought to be, because he doesn't study that either.
Do you view his response to the pandemic as a national security concern?
I do. I think he's failed. I think he, in the early days, did not want to hear anything critical of China, even though NSC staffers and Centers for Disease Control staffers in early January were sounding the alarm because he didn't want to conceive that the pandemic, as it turned out to be, could have a dramatically negative impact on the U.S. economy and therefore his ticket to reelection. I think we've all suffered the consequences as a result. And, his attitude toward China, his rhetoric at least now is very harsh. The administration's taken some tough steps. But I wouldn't be surprised if he wins a second term after the election. He'll be right back on the phone to Xi Jinping talking about the trade deal.
And now the current National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien has tested positive for COVID-19. Does it surprise you that the virus has traveled that close to the Oval Office?
It doesn't, because I think they weren't taking adequate protections. And, we have to hope it doesn't spread further. You don't want the top decision makers of the country incapacitated.
Finally, John Bolton, you've said on several occasions that Donald Trump is unfit to be president. What do you mean by unfit, and where does that concern take you?
Well, I don't think he fully understands the office or what it entails. He doesn't consider the consequences of his decisions. He doesn't proceed on the basis of philosophy or grand strategy or even consistent policy. And I think in the national security space, that's very, very dangerous. I think the country can recover from the damage that Trump has done in his first term, actually fairly quickly. But I'm more worried about the corrosive effects of two Trump terms.
John Bolton is President Trump's former national security advisor. He's the author of The Room Where It Happened, a White House memoir. Ambassador, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
With less than 3 months until Election Day, every move, every statement, every tweet the president makes will be hyper-scrutinized, more than ever. Some Latino immigrants in the U.S. cannot legally vote, but they hold plenty of sway within their communities, and their opinions have impact. Today, as part of our weekly series we call Every 30 Seconds, that's how long it takes for another Latino to become eligible to vote in the U.S., we're looking at the power at the polls of undocumented immigrants. Here's the world's Monica Campbell.
Julio Humeta remembers seeing his dad after years apart.
It was February of 2001. I just remember seeing my dad in front of the house, just waiting for us. And I just ran up to him and hugged him.
Humeta was 7 years old and had just migrated up to Milwaukee, Wisconsin with his mom to reunite with his dad. They'd left Mexico because they'd struggled to get by there ever since a flood destroyed their home.
My family didn't have a bank account. We didn't have any savings. Everything we owned was in that house. My mom told me that my parents would skip meals so my sister and I would be able to eat.
That's why his dad was in Wisconsin to work and send money home. Humeta and his family are now rooted in Milwaukee. His parents remain undocumented, though. Humeta, who's 26 now, has a work permit, but it depends on DACA, the program for younger immigrants that the Trump administration is trying to end. A lot hangs in the balance for Humeta, but while he can't vote in November, he's making sure others do.
I've been talking to all my friends to make sure that they register to vote, request their absentee ballots. Honestly, anybody that I meet that I have any political conversation with, I always do some voter education.
Some organizations, like the large immigrant rights group United We Dream, are rallying national networks of undocumented people to convince others to vote.
Hey, everyone. We're out here at Shenandoah Public Library. One of many early voting sites. Today is the last day to early vote.
Now. Do not wait until Tuesday.
Those were volunteers in Florida urging people to vote in Creole, too, ahead of the 2018 midterms. Some wore yellow shirts that said, "Live unafraid." Juanita Monsalve with United We Dream says that the group got volunteers to knock on over 700,000 doors in California, Texas, Florida, and New Mexico. Monsalve hopes to replicate this ahead of November, except the big difference is they'll reach out to people online. And people are encouraged to talk about immigration and why programs like DACA are important to them, but other issues too.
Being undocumented isn't solely about having papers or not, right? About whether you have citizenship or not. It's also about having access to healthcare. It's also about having access to the rights of your job and ensuring that people are not stealing your wages, right? And so it's also about having access to education for so many young people.
Some initiatives are also nonpartisan and just want people from immigrant communities to vote. Cristian Solano Cordova, who is a DACA recipient, is with the Colorado Immigrant Rights Coalition in Denver. For him, his initiative starts at home, his home.
I recently learned that my husband hasn't voted in like years, and he'd kind of been hiding that from me. He told me he was. He felt like his vote wouldn't really matter. But I'm like, hey, think about it as like giving me half of your vote. Vote for me.
In Wisconsin, for Julio Humeta, immigration is just one of his concerns. The pandemic's hit his family hard. He lost his job at a nonprofit after it downsized. His mom and grandma are quarantined with the virus. Humeta's dad, who makes minimum wage at a spice and condiment factory, is the family's only breadwinner. Meals now come from the food bank. Humeta knows his family's dilemma is common now, especially in immigrant communities.
I still have fears for people who are undocumented. And I think that the government needs to step up and do something. I think that the Democrats' plan for aid, that they have some money, especially for people who are undocumented is something that we really need. People are here struggling for their lives.
Humeta also says he talks to anyone he can, Democrats, Republicans, knowing every vote in Wisconsin counts. His strategy is just to tell his story, why his family left Mexico, the flood that ruined their home, the hunger they experienced.
I know, like myself, people don't like to talk about these things. They're hard to talk about, obviously. But I think it's important that we share our stories. Not everyone is aware of what goes on and why we are here.
For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
Before we take a short break, I wanted to let you know about one more way you can connect with us. How about an espresso shot of news stories from around the globe to start your morning? Our team here at The World delivers it right to your email. Sign up for our morning newsletter, Top of the World, on our website, theworld.org/newsletters. Let's take a journey 9,000 miles due south to Antarctica. And a good news nature story from The World's Anna Kussmer.
That's the sound of an emperor penguin colony. They're in the news this week because the species is doing a lot better than we thought. Scientists released a new study that found 11 previously undiscovered colonies along Antarctica's coast.
Some of these colonies were suspected before, but most of them are totally new to science.
Peter Fretwell at the British Antarctic Survey led the study. How'd he find the missing penguins? It's not exactly easy for scientists to trek around the icy continent. So Fretwell and his team used satellite imagery to find, well, penguin poo.
Technical term guano, but you can call it poo if you like.
Technical term guano, but you can call it poo if you like, he said there, on a less than optimal Zoom connection. Anyway, guano, poo, semantics. But snapping pictures of penguin droppings from space was key for scientists.
They're quite messy birds. They live on the ice for about 9 months of the year. The ice should be pure white. And we go and look for these browny-red stains on the sea ice, which are quite distinctive of emperor penguin colonies.
Fretwell says the findings shocked some penguin scientists and show that the global emperor penguin population may be 20% higher than previously thought. Great news, he says.
Because this is a species which is vulnerable to global warming and climate change. So having more penguins is definitely good news.
Next up, Fretwell says they want to snap some more photos to get a better look at the penguins themselves, not just the droppings they leave behind. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
And one more piece of good news from Antarctica. There are no reported cases of coronavirus down there. Yesterday's explosion truly could not have come at a worse time for people in Lebanon. They're already dealing with a pandemic. That came on top of the country in a state of social unrest as their economy collapses under the weight of decades of political corruption. And then this explosion that seems to have ripped the city apart. Carmen Guija is an activist and associate professor of public administration at the American University of Beirut. First of all, Carmen, how are you and your family after yesterday's explosion? I understand you were at home at the time. What'd you go through?
Me and my family are alive and well, but not doing so well, but better than others. Yeah, I was at home and the entire building shook.
And did you have any understanding of what was going on? When did you realize what it was?
Yeah, maybe it took an hour until some propaganda was circulating about fireworks. And then a couple of hours later, we were told that it was an accident, that some ammonium nitrate, some 2,750 kilograms. A quick analysis would show an expert opinion would tell you that this stuff doesn't just happen, that it's not some guy who lit a match by mistake. I mean, there's a disaster that occurred yesterday. They knew that this atomium was there, and they knew this since 2014, and this is according to state authorities. So I would say that the detonation is deliberate, even if deliberate means negligent on the part of our stupid, incompetent government.
So an explosion of this size, it is a sad metaphor for the accrual of trouble in Lebanon. This tragedy comes at a time when Lebanon is in a deep economic crisis, as I was saying. Many people have lost their life savings overnight, and just read that Lebanon recently became the first country in the Middle East to suffer from hyperinflation. Now hundreds of thousands of people are displaced. So what is the sense in the streets today of Lebanon's future?
Yeah, I mean, we've been saying for years that we have a political time bomb. We've been years calling for support, protesting, running for elections, raising money. I was thinking, what can we say this time that is a real cry for help? And I think all what it needs to say is that this is a Hiroshima. I mean, they bombed us and they woke up and created an investigation committee in a country where we don't trust the judiciary. I just learned that the director general of the port who knew of the chemicals is actually on the investigation committee. So the feeling on the street, as you can imagine, is beyond anger. I think people want revenge. They killed our children, our families, our nurses. One hospital had to evacuate 306 people. There's a pandemic going on. Already we don't have enough hospital beds. It's carnage. I mean, they committed a massacre last night. It's been 24 hours and we've not even buried our dead. So the movement on the street, the feeling is that's enough. People, you know, the hashtag trending in Arabic is we want to hang them.
Mm. Yeah. And the context here, Carmen, is that you've been part of protests that erupted back in 2019 against the corruption of the ruling elite in Lebanon. You succeeded in toppling the government, but the new administration, we hear, has done really little to alleviate the worsening living conditions. How much faith do people have in their leadership after a tragedy like this?
Zero faith, even before. We toppled the government, as in we changed names and we replaced them with other names, but we didn't have enough time and luxury to really change the structures, the clientelistic nature, because we protested for 4 months. And then we lost our salaries, and then there was a pandemic. So it has really been a very unfortunate year in terms of trying to organize, right? But what is very strong in Lebanon, and the message I want to say, is that there are very strong social institutions, community groups. Right now in Martyr Square, people have set up makeshift tents collecting food and glass and recycling material to help people rebuild their homes. And it's these people that need to have a voice and a say over this investigation and the future of their country.
The Lebanese people have rightfully earned a reputation over many challenging decades to be resourceful, to be resilient. How do you see Lebanon recovering from all of this, Carmen?
Yeah, not this time.
What do you mean?
You know, a lot has been said about this resilient. What's resilient? Is it good to be resilient? But I think this time it's very difficult to stand on our own two feet if we have to do it alone, you know, with it's too much. I want to say, you know, Beirut will rise, Lebanon will rise, but not this time and certainly not alone.
So help me understand that. Will Lebanese be leaving the country? And are you giving up?
I don't know. So far, I'm not giving up. I think we're all still in a bit of shock and a bit of trauma. So I haven't thought this one over. I'm not leaving, but a lot of people will leave. It doesn't mean that there's not hope, but it means that we're really at a tipping point. And I don't know how much breath people still have to continue fighting this time, frankly.
So, Carmen, I really would like to end on a positive note. I mean, as sad and as tragic as things are in Beirut today, what do you love about the city? What do you want to see it come back to?
Yeah. Well, it's home, right? It's home.
It's home, yeah.
Yeah.
Carmen Geha is an activist and associate professor of public administration at the American University of Beirut. Carmen, thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thanks, Marco.
We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston. Thanks very much for being with us today. From PR.